I very much listen to the shiur.
Oh yeah,
but I have to. I leave in the middle, so I hope you're Muslim.
That's right.
It's
that's
not Derech Chavah.
I hope I didn't say anything that offended you. That's
no. If you see me, I've got a tight schedule, so nothing personal. Chas v'shalom.
Everybody, since we are approaching Rosh Hashanah, we're in the month of Elul, I wanted to talk about some general things, although I know that obviously this may overlap with other people, but perhaps this will not. And that is, first of all of us know that Rosh Hashanah is coming, and although we define Rosh Hashanah as the beginning of the year, and indeed, that's how we count our years, right? We're finishing 5,775, and we're moving into 5,776. And what are we counting from? We are counting from the creation of Adam HaRishon. Adam was created on Rosh Hashanah, which was a Friday that year, which is interesting. In our present calendar, Rosh Hashanah can never be on Friday, but the first Rosh Hashanah was on Friday. Which actually means God started creating the world 6 days earlier, the 25th of Elul. But the culmination of creation was the creation of man that has free will, and the purpose of creation is that man should choose to serve Hashem. And that is why Rosh Hashanah became the day of judgment, because every anniversary of creation, God decides whether it's a worthwhile endeavor, like a business evaluates itself every year. It's the fiscal year. Now, that is the meaning of the phrase we recite in our Rosh Hashanah prayers, Hayom Haras Olam. Today is the birthday of the world, Haras Olam, the birthday of the world, and that is why God judges us. Now, in point, let me just point out that in spite of this, there is actually an argument in the Gemara, was the world created in the month of Nisan, or was the world created in the month of Tishrei? Rabbi Eliezer says, the world was created in the month of Tishrei, which is exactly what I told you. Hashem began creating the world the 25th of Elul. By the way, I'm not addressing the fascinating issue, maybe we'll take it up in a question and answer, about how long were the days, you know, in terms of age of the earth, you know, maybe the days were not 24 hours. That's a separate issue, and you know, we can talk about that some other time. But according to Rabbi Eliezer, God began creating the world the 25th of Elul, and man was created on Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei. This is Rabbi Eliezer's view. Rabbi Yehoshua has a totally different view. He says, God started creating the world the 25th of Adar, in other words, in the springtime, and man was created on the first day of Nisan. Now, here's the question. Surely, Rabbi Yehoshua kept the holiday of Rosh Hashanah. He didn't keep Rosh Hashanah during Pesach time. I mean, the Torah says, on the first day of Tishrei, you have to have a holiday. And this is called the Day of Judgment. So the interesting question you might ponder is, why is Rosh Hashanah the Day of Judgment according to Rabbi Yehoshua's chronology of how the world was created? Everyone get the question? Meaning the following. The Torah itself gives me a holiday, Rosh Hashanah, the first of Tishrei. And we have a tradition. On the first of Tishrei, God judges the whole world, who will live, who will die, and a preliminary judgment is made on Rosh Hashanah, and then you have 10 days to try to get better, and the final decision is made on Yom Kippur, right? This is Mekubal. Now the question is, according to Rabbi Eliezer, this makes logical sense, because man was created on Rosh Hashanah, and that is why God judges you on Rosh Hashanah, who will live and who will die. But the question is, according to Rabbi Yehoshua, who says that God started creating the world the 25th of Adar, and man was created Rosh Chodesh Nisan, why would the first of Tishrei, which seems to be apropos of nothing, there seems to be nothing that happens on the first of Tishrei, why would the first of Tishrei be the day that God set aside to judge who will live and who will die? It is not the anniversary of my creation. Right? That's an interesting question. How does Rabbi Yehoshua understand Rosh Hashanah? Now, I don't want to confuse you. Let me point out that in the Machzor absolutely follows the view of Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Yehoshua must have had a different text in his prayers, because the Machzor does say, Hayom Haras Olam, this is the birthday of the world. It does say this is the anniversary of Adam's creation. But what's important to understand is that sometimes even something like the Machzor might only be following one view of our sages, and there would be other views of our sages that would have to have made a modification in the text of the Machzor. So one answer to my question is found in the Ran. The Ran is Rabbeinu Nissim, one of the great Talmudic commentators. But I have to go back, because this is not a complete answer now that I'm recalling it. His answer is that, putting aside the idea that man was created on Rosh Hashanah, because according to Rabbi Yehoshua, that's not true, there is something very significant about the entire 40 days from the beginning of the month of Elul all the way to Yom Kippur, those 40 days. And those 40 days were, if you remember, in the aftermath of the golden calf, when we were in the desert, much, much later than creation. So God wanted to destroy the whole Jewish people, and God wanted to make a private covenant with Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, of course, I don't want any private deals. You either forgive the Jewish people, or if you don't forgive them, take me out of your book. I don't want to be part of it. And Moses prayed and prayed and prayed, and the Jewish people did tshuva. And then finally Hashem told Moshe, go up to Mount Sinai for another 40 days, and I will give you the Torah a second time. Well, what was that last period of 40 days? Moshe went up on the first of the month of Elul, and he came down 40 days later on Yom Kippur. And now we have an interesting chicken and egg problem. And that is the following. The day that we got the second tablets, and that God finally forgave the sin of the golden calf, was on Yom Kippur. But what is the cause and effect? Is it the idea that God forgave us for the sin of the golden calf because it was Yom Kippur? Or did Yom Kippur become a day of forgiveness because that was the day that God forgave the sin of the golden calf? Meaning, was Yom Kippur the reason for the forgiveness? Or was the forgiveness the reason for Yom Kippur? Well, there are different ways of looking at it. You can't say for sure. Some understand that Yom Kippur became the day of forgiveness because that was the day that God forgave us. That brought forgiveness into the world. Others say Yom Kippur was destined to be the day of forgiveness, and that's why God forgave us. But it turns out, because of this idea, which has nothing to do with creation of the world, the 40 days between Elul and Yom Kippur are days of grace, days of divine love, days of divine compassion. So the Ran wants to say that God wanted to judge us in the season of the year in which there is great compassion and mercy. It's as if God schedules the judgment at a time of mercy. Now, the only thing is, this is not a complete answer to me, because this doesn't explain why the first of Tishrei. I mean, you have 40 days, so God could have chosen, you know, any day in that continuum. If you're simply telling me that God wanted first of Tishrei because it's located in the 40 days of mercy, that really does not explain bidiyuk why the first of Tishrei. But again, I'm going to have to go back and check, and I'll report back to you, where you can even check yourself. But the point I want to share with you is that the common statement that we always say, that Rosh Hashanah is the anniversary of the creation of man, of the human being, is only true according to the chronology of Rabbi Eliezer, which the Machzor follows. The Machzor follows that chronology. It is actually not true, according to the chronology of Rabbi Yoshua, where we were actually created in the first day of Nisan. But even like Rabbi Yoshua, the day of judgment is Rosh Hashanah, because God wanted to locate the day of judgment within the 40 days of mercy, the Yemei Ratzon, the days of grace, the days when God is very, very close. All of you know that, I'm sure you've heard and learned, that one of the most important allusions to the month of Elul is a verse in the Song of Songs. Ani lidodi vidodi. Let me explain that a little bit. Again, I apologize if you've heard all of this, but some of you might not. We have a book in the Bible that is called Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. And according to the Sefer, it was written by none other than King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, who is the wisest of all people. Now, if you read Shir HaShirim, it is written as a romantic love song. It's very, very passionate. It uses imagery of a man-woman relationship. It uses openly sexual imagery. And in fact, there were rabbis who thought that Shir HaShirim should not be admitted into the Bible because it did not have holiness. It was simply a profane love song. So it was like, as the expression goes, it was going to be banned in Boston. They were going to say, you know, this does not belong in a Jewish home. So who was the rabbi who convinced all of the sages that this was divine, this was holy, this was worthy of inclusion? It was the great Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva said, if all of the songs in the Bible are holy, the Song of Songs is the holiest of the holy. Because the Song of Songs is a metaphor. It is using the man-woman relationship to symbolize the relationship of God to the Jewish people. So the idea is that the passion and the love that a man might feel for a woman might feel for a man, that is exactly the love, infinitely deeper way, that Hashem has for Am Yisrael. So every single pasuk, Rabbi Akiva said, has a metaphorical, symbolic meaning. So that's why if you look at the Art Scroll translation, this is an old attack on Art Scroll, and I don't mean to attack them, they do great stuff. But, you know, they say they do not translate the Song of Songs literally, because they say it'll be misunderstood as a love song. So when the pasuk says in Shir HaShirim, my lover has embraced me with passionate kisses, they will translate, you read the English, when God took us out of Egypt, he gave us the man from heaven. And you know, you're reading that, you say, what's the big controversy here? Oh, God gave us the man, okay, I know that. But no, in the Hebrew, it says something very, very different. It uses the language of passion and intimacy, which symbolically refers to all of God's love, but in fact, Shir HaShirim uses sexual imagery. Now, yeah?
Who wrote this book, sorry?
King Solomon. Okay. King Solomon wrote this book. Now, the question you might ask yourself is the following. And Art Scroll defends its decision, and they say that their poskim told them this, they defend their decision by saying, if we give you a literal translation, you will misunderstand the significance of the book, so we need to give you a non-literal, symbolic translation, so you will not be misled. This is their statement. So here's my question. King Solomon is said to be the wisest of all people. He didn't write Shir HaShirim that way. He wrote Shir HaShirim in the way that Art Scroll claims will be misunderstood. Why didn't he write, when God took us out of Egypt, he gave us the man? Why did he write, my lover has, you know, enveloped me with passionate kisses and embraces? Why did he write it in a way that is prone to be misunderstood? So in truth, the Art Scroll itself gives you the answer in a Hebrew letter. At the beginning of the book, they publish an untranslated Hebrew letter from Rav Mordechai Gifter, Zichrono Livracha, one of the great Rosh Yeshivas, who actually gives a beautiful, beautiful reason, which is untranslated. It's in the Art Scroll, but it's untranslated. And he says the following idea. He says, the Song of Songs is a mashal. It is a parable for something deeper. 100%. But you can't understand the inner meaning unless you're capable of the outer meaning. Meaning to say, unless you're capable of loving other human beings, unless you're capable of going beyond your egotism and your selfishness, unless you're capable of feeling passion with another, you're not capable of loving God. Because God cannot be loved as an abstraction. We learn to love God by the love we have to fellow human beings. Now, in a marriage, that love exists on one level. Outside of a marriage, it lives through friendship, caring, compassion. In other words, the idea of Shir HaShirim is you don't understand the inner meaning unless you're capable of understanding the outer meaning. God cannot be loved as an abstraction. God is loved through the love that we have for other human beings. And that is why Shir HaShirim uses human love as the petach, as the opening to divine love. You know, it's reminiscent of Leo Tolstoy. All of you have heard of Leo Tolstoy, the famous author of War and Peace. So Tolstoy was a member of the Russian aristocracy in the time of the Tsars. He was Count Leo Tolstoy. And in those days, Russia had slavery. And the slavery were called serfs. And Tolstoy was a social reformer. Tolstoy wrote a number of books about abolition, besides War and Peace and Anna Karenina. He wrote social reform. He wrote social reform tracts. He wrote a book against slavery, etc. So somebody once asked him, Count Tolstoy, I don't understand. You wrote a beautiful book about universal liberty, independence, human rights. How come you don't free your slaves? And how come you mistreat your slaves? You seem to be a hypocrite. You advocate liberty and you own slaves. His answer was, just because I love humanity doesn't mean I have to care about people. Now, he understood what he meant. What he meant to say is, and this is sometimes human nature, I love global causes, I'm committed to humanity and equality, but I'm not nice to the person who lives next to me. You know, often people are very taken up by great, great causes. But it doesn't translate to the decency they show in the here and now. Judaism is starting with the other side of the coin. You want to love God? I love the Jewish people, but I can't stand my roommate? You got to start with the here and now. You start with the specific, and you work outwards. With the secretaries you meet, or the policemen, or the firemen. Or whatever it is. We try to be nice, we try to be mentioned, we try to be decent, we try to be loving to the people in our immediate circles. And then we grow outwards, 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 and we learn to love God and the like. That is why Shir HaShirim uses the metaphor of human relations for loving God. By the way, as an aside, although it's not really our topic, I just want to mention an amazing thought of the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon takes this one step further. The Vilna Gaon says, all human love is really divine love. Why? Because when I love a human being, if it's not just physical desire, what do I love in a human being? Whether it's a friend, a wife, a parent, a child. I love qualities. It might be their goodness, it might be their wisdom, it might be their understanding, it might be their compassion. What I love are the godly qualities of the soul, because every human being is made in the image of God. Our souls are from God. So what I love in a person is that part of the person that is their godly essence. So really, what I truly love is God, because my soul comes from God, and therefore whenever I feel within another person something that comes from God, I'm attracted to that person because I feel their godliness on one level, whatever it might be. I might feel a different aspect of their godliness, and people are attracted to different qualities, but whether it's their wisdom, their generosity, their kindness, what is attracting me is the godliness that is within them. And therefore the Vilna Gaon says all human love, if it's not just, as I say, if it's not just desire, all human love is divine love. That is the Song of Songs, using human love as a metaphor for divine love. Now, to get back to the main point, why did I bring any of this in? The answer is that one of the most important refrains in the Song of Songs, a verse that appears several times, or a phrase that appears several times, is a very, very well-known phrase. Ani lidodi vidodi li. What does that mean in English? I pledge myself to my beloved. Ani lidodi, my beloved. And my beloved pledges himself to me. Like the Jewish people, or the woman is saying about her lover, the Jewish people are saying about God, I am for my beloved, and my beloved is for me. By the way, Friday night, we have the famous song that everyone sings when we welcome the Shabbos. L'cha dodi, l'kras kala, come my beloved to greet the bride, the Shabbos queen. The word dodi is taken from the Song of Songs, and fascinatingly enough, this is very, very wonderful. Some people give you a watered-down translation. They simply say, come my friends to greet the bride. But now that you know Shir HaShirim, it's very different. Dodi does not mean my friends. Come my beloved to greet the bride. I guess some water it down. And the beloved you're speaking to is not your next door neighbor, you're speaking to God, as if God and you are welcoming the Shabbos together. Come, my beloved, because in Shir HaShirim we call God our beloved one. Now, let's take those four words again. Ani lidodi, I am for my beloved. Vidodi li, and my beloved is for me. Okay? Take the first letter of each of those words. Ani is Aleph. Lidodi is Lamed. Vidodi, Vav, Li, Lamed. It spells the word Elul, the month of Elul. So what is Elul? Elul is the special month of the year where God's love is so great that I am for my beloved and my beloved is for me. Right? Elul. So that's very interesting. On one hand, we are approaching the day of judgment, so people get scared and people get anxious. On the other hand, this is the great month of love. There's a famous, famous mashal, a famous, famous parable that is used from Hasidim. I think it's from the Baal Shem Tov, although Chabad uses it all the time, but it's earlier than Chabad. It goes back to the Baal Shem Tov. That the month of Elul is called the month where the Melech is Basadeh. Melech Basadeh means the king is in the field. What is the concept of the king in the field? Imagine you have a king. And the king is a good king, the king is a righteous king, and the king is willing to meet with anybody who needs to see him. But during the year, the king is in his palace. So you have to make an appointment, you have to go through secretaries, you have to fit in with the king's schedule. But once a year, the king decides to leave the palace, wander in the streets, wander in the fields, without guards, without an entourage, without secretaries, without schedulers, without photo ops. And anybody who wants to approach him can go over to the king for an audience. The Baal Shem Tov said, the month of Elul is that month where the king is in the field. The king is available. Hashem is available the whole year, there's no question about it. But Elul is that special time when it's easier to connect to the Almighty. Famous, famous mashal. In other words, people just refer to it as Elul is HaMelech Basadeh. Right? So if you're at a chassid's house, you can impress the chassid by saying, oh yes, HaMelech Basadeh. And he'll look at you and say, how did you know that? Okay, but this is a very, very well-known mashal about Elul that one should know about. Okay. Right, so the point is, therefore, there's kind of a cognitive dissonance, two contradictory ideas. Because on one hand, I'm not going to deny, among a truly religious Jew, there's a certain fear and trepidation because, our lives are up in the balance. God is going to decide who will live and who will die. It's pretty scary. We're up for trial for our lives. and things do happen. On the other hand, we also have to feel secure in God's divine love, that He wants us to succeed. He wants us to be close to Him. He wants us to make the choices that will connect us with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know, there's a beautiful saying. Everybody says this when you wake up in the morning. So as soon as you open your eyes, so the first thing you should do, although Baruch Hashem, you probably don't have to do this yet, you have to check the obituaries to see that you're okay. You know, people say, older people, it's an old person's job, they say that. They don't get up till they read the obituaries that day, and then they, when they see they're not in there, they get up. But okay. But, you know, what is the first thing we say before we even wash our hands? Because you don't say God's name yet. Modeh ani lefanecha melech chai v'kayam. I give thanks to you, the eternal God, Shechazarta bi nishmasi. You returned my soul after sleep. You returned my life that I can function. Bechemla, with mercy and graciousness. Period. Bechemla. And then we end the sentence. Rabba emunasecha. Your faith is great. Your faith is great. Now the question that Mefarshim ask is, we shouldn't say, your faith is great. Faith is what I have in God. I should say, my faith is great. Why do I say, your faith is great? The answer is, it's God's faith in us. That every single morning, He gives us back our life. He is telling you, you're worth it. You have what to accomplish. You have a mission. You have potential. You have greatness that is within you. Because if there was nothing left for me to accomplish, why would God give me life again? So that's a wonderful thing. God has faith in us, even when we can sometimes lose faith in ourselves. So, you know, a person goes through life, and a person encounters, you know, difficulties. A person encounters negativity. A person encounters failures, mistakes, disappointment. They could be major things, could be minor things. You didn't get into the school you wanted to get into, didn't make the basketball team, whatever it would be. You're just not getting Gemara, just not clicking. And all of this strange language, you might have been like an A student in college and you come here and then you see a fourth grader who seems to, you know things better. By the way, I experienced that too, you know, sometimes, depending on the fourth grader. You know, so the thing is, we sometimes feel like, you know, what's the point? We sometimes get a little depressed. We sometimes feel that we're not able to accomplish. But I think the answer to that is, if you woke up this morning, the master of the universe made a judgment that there is good stuff you can do. He gave you life. And therefore, God has confidence in you that you can succeed. You can do well. And therefore, no matter what negative feedback I get from other people, you know, this is easier said than done. I'm not saying it's easy to do. But like, who cares what other people say? If God said, I'm okay. See? I mean, Hashem said you're okay. What's the proof? Because you're alive. If you're alive, and Hashem didn't have to give us life. If He did, He says, you're okay. It's like the old t-shirt saying, you know, t-shirt sayings are always true. That's why they're t-shirt sayings. Great repositories of wisdom. You know, God doesn't make junk. Have you seen that one? God doesn't make junk. Very, very true. God doesn't make junk. God made you. You know, you're good. There's good stuff that you can do. Good stuff that you can accomplish. Don't get down on yourself. Sometimes there are going to be setbacks, but we become stronger by overcoming those challenges. We become greater than we would have been had things been easy. Easy come, easy go. No pay, no gain. I'm using cliches today for whatever reason. But the concept is, you know, what comes easy goes easy. You work hard for something. It really becomes part of you. And, you know, you bring HaKadosh Baruch Hu nachas. You bring Him joy and satisfaction and the like. So that's what you got to remember about the month of Elul. On one hand, there's a certain amount of scariness that we have. Fear and trepidation. But this is the month of Ani Lidodi Bidodi Li. I am for my beloved. My beloved is for me. This is HaMelech Basadeh. The king is in the field. available for everybody to get to him. Now, let me mention another remes. Remes are simply allusions in the Torah to the month of Elul. Now, the first allusion is not in the Torah; it's in the Song of Songs, which is not in the Torah; it's in the writings. But this one is actually in the Torah itself. But it was identified by the Arizal, the great Kabbalist, the Ari, in the 16th century. And this involves the din of Ir Miklat. You're familiar with Ir Miklat? We actually read it 2 weeks ago. Ir Miklat is a city of refuge. And this is a very interesting halacha, that if I kill somebody, not on purpose, I kill somebody by accident, but I did it in such a way that I was careless, meaning I went through a stop sign, or I didn't look when I was backing up, and God forbid that happens, I ran over a child. In other words, what we would call in secular law, we would call it manslaughter. Not murder, but manslaughter. We're not talking about unavoidable accidents. We're not talking about a building collapsed and I fell on somebody. We're talking about, I didn't do it on purpose, but I should have been more careful. So what does the Torah say happens to such a person? There were six cities in Israel. The inhabitants, the permanent inhabitants, were Levim, the Levites. And if you were a murderer who was convicted of this, you would go to those cities of refuge. And it was kind of like city arrest. You're like, it's arrest, but it's not really, you know, you have the whole city, but you cannot leave that city. And if you leave that city, the so-called blood avenger, the relative, would be allowed to kill you. But as long as you're in that city, you are safe. And you remain in that city, very, very strange. A strange sentence. You remain in that city until the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, dies. Now that's a very strange sentence. If he dies a day after you went to the city, you go home after a day. If he dies 50 years later, you're stuck in that city for 50 years. If you die first, you are buried in the city until the Kohen Gadol dies. Then you're taken out and buried. Very, very strange. Because of this, the Talmud records that the mothers of the high priest used to bring care packages and goodies to the people in the Ir Miklat so they shouldn't try to arrange for their sons to get killed. Because you understand that, hey, if my son goes free, you know, if the Kohen Gadol dies, I'll hire a hitman or whatever it is. So because of this, they would kind of bribe the people in the Ir Miklat, don't try to get rid of my son either by praying to Hashem or by hiring a hitman or whatever. Okay, so this is called Ir Miklat, a city of refuge. So the Arizal, strangely enough, identified a remez to the month of Elul in the Parsha dealing with Ir Miklat. What's the remez? Let me first give you the allusion, then we'll talk about the meaning. The allusion is, the Pasuk says, Asher lo tzada, he who did not premeditate, meaning it's not a premeditated murder, Elokim ina liyado, God has prepared a place for him to run away. So if you take four words, ina, liyado, prepared for him, lanus shama, right, to run there. So if you count, ina liyado v'samti l'charai, ina liyado, first letter aleph, liyado lamed, v'samti, I placed, l'cha, for you. So it's Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed. The four words are Ina, Liado, V'samti, Lecha. Again, first letters, Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed. So Elul is encoded in a parsha dealing with the city of refuge. Now, what's the connection here? City of refuge is for murderers. What exactly is the connection? What the Arizal is teaching us is a very, very fundamental truth. A city of refuge is not like a prison. Right? Someone goes to prison, they come into prison a minor criminal, they'll come out a major criminal. Who do you hang around with when you're in prison? You hang around with rapists, murderers. I mean, basically, talk about, you know, take a person who commits a crime and put him in a place where everybody is bad. That's not likely to bring a person to tshuva. The Ir Miklat, by contrast, you're putting him with Kohanim and Levim, good influences, people that can elevate him, people that can inspire him, an environment of holiness. The Ir Miklat is a holy city. It's like saying, a person who kills, he goes to a holy place. So, an Ir Miklat is a spiritual refuge in space. The month of Elul is a spiritual refuge in time. A cocoon where we can try to improve ourselves and purify our character. But what's the comparison to murder? Because the truth of the matter is, all of us are murderers. What do you mean, all of us are murderers? I didn't murder anybody. Well, first of all, keep in mind that Chazal say that if we humiliate other people, we're like murderers of them, right? So perhaps we've murdered other people. We've broken their spirit. We've hurt people in different ways. Sometimes psychological pain can be more grave than even physical suffering. But more than that, we are actually self-murderers. Because if we don't use our life in the way we're supposed to use it, we're literally killing our lives. You know, when people, it's been said, wasting time is suicide. Why is that? Because what is life but a succession of minutes? Minutes, hours, days, months. If I simply don't use my time, I'm throwing away my life. Now, we're not intentional murderers because we don't do it on purpose. And that's why we have a city of refuge. But we're careless, we're not always thinking properly. And therefore, just like the unintentional murderer needs a geographical city of refuge, the unintentional spiritual murderer needs a temporal city of refuge. And the month of Elul is the Ir Miklat for the unintentional murderer that we are of ourselves. That is why there is a teaching in Chazal that one should think of the day of death. Now you might say, oh, that's very depressing. And one is not supposed to be depressed. One is supposed to serve God with joy. So what I would suggest to you is, thinking about mortality is not supposed to make us sad. But it's supposed to make us realize how precious life is. That you, what is carpe diem, right? Seize the moment. Make every moment count. Because if we would live forever, we would never have an incentive to do anything. I'll get to this 10,000 years from now, plenty of time. A person doesn't have plenty of time. You got to seize the moment. You got to use the moment. You have to treasure the moment. Life is very, very precious. You're able to do mitzvahs, you're able to build relationships, you're able to do goodness. You're able to accomplish wonderful, wonderful things. So you remember your finiteness in the sense of using every moment in a good way. And therefore we are murderers in a sense of ourselves. We have an Ir Miklat. We have a city of refuge. And that is the month of Elul. Okay, so that's the Arizal's reference to the month of Elul in the Torah itself, that Elul is treated as an Ir Miklat, to treasure life. You know, Rebbe Kiveger once gave a beautiful mashal. David HaMelech says, I rejoice over your Torah as if I found a great treasure. So what's the analogy to a great treasure? So Rebbe Kiveger once compared life this way. Imagine a king puts you on an island, and the island is like a miraculous island. It is filled with diamonds and rubies and sapphires. and pearls. And the king says, you have 24 hours on this island. Whatever you can take is yours. Assuming you have enough baskets and everything. But after the 24 hours, that's it. You only get what you can take in those 24 hours. So on one hand, there's this amazing joy that every second I get another diamond, another pearl. But there's also going to be a certain sadness. Because no matter how much I take, most of it is going to be left behind. David HaMelech compared Torah this way as well. We're put on this world for a certain amount of time. And God says, any Torah mitzvah you want to do is yours. So every second I get a diamond, a diamond, a diamond, a diamond. But there's a certain sadness because no matter what I take, you know, there's so much I'm leaving behind. But still, there's so much we can take, so much we can grow. You know, so this is kind of the message of treasuring your life, and especially when you come to yeshiva, you're only here for perhaps a limited amount of time. You're in Jerusalem, you're in Eretz Yisrael, and you know you can take everything for granted. Even Yerushalayim we can take for granted, unfortunately. But just know that this is a very, very precious time of your life, and there's so many jewels that you can take. And may God inspire you all to take all the jewels that you can. And then, you know, you're seizing the moment, and, you know, one comes to the new year with that sense of renewal that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give you much, much bracha. So, see you tomorrow.
Can you translate these to English books? These four books. Ahavas Hesed.
Ahavas Hesed is loving kindness, love of kindness.
It's a book, right?
It's a book written by the Chafetz Chaim, yes.
Kindness.
Yes.
And the next.